Academic integrity, take two. How often do students cheat? When my daughter was in her first year of university studies, she described a situation that happened in her chemistry class. The class had about 100 students in it, and this happened towards the start of the term. They had the class in a small lecture hall with fixed and tiered seating and a semicircle around the front stage area, the area where the instructor would usually stand. At the end of the class, the instructor collected the homework that had been due that day. While the instructor waited for the assignments to be handed in down the rows, students around my daughter openly looked at her answers and those of other students that had been around her. As students passed the homework from the left to the right across the rows, some paused and hung on to it to check their answers with some of those from the other students. Now, the instructor stood at the end of the rows of seats, collected the answer sheets, and then left. My daughter had the distinct feeling that nothing odd was going on, that it was all quite ordinary. I open with this vignette because it is both dramatic and prosaic. At the time, I was shocked by this activity, but probably shouldn't have been. As my father explained to me when I was in my teens, the world isn't fair. Get over it. Well, if you're a teacher and instructor at any level, I guess the paraphrase here would be, some students cheat. Get over it. I don't mean to let students cheat. That's not the message here. I just mean that you have to understand that some students will cheat if given the opportunity. And this is a condition of existence. And you just need to plan accordingly around that fact. This podcast episode is the second in a series of three podcast episodes and blog posts probing academic integrity with a focus on online environments. In the first episode, I spoke with Ellen Watson of the University of Alberta's Center for Teaching and Learning. In that episode and in the accompanying blog post, we sketched out some strategies to use when planning online courses, and these strategies would help discourage cheating. One question that I asked after doing that episode was, well, how much of a problem is cheating? How much time and effort should an instructor devote to preventing it? In this, the second episode, I try to establish some kind of context for instructors so they can decide for themselves how much cheating is likely occurring in their classes. In the third episode, I'll talk about how to talk with students when they've done something that looks like cheating to you. So let's get started. How much do students cheat? Well, let's ask them and see what they say. Here's some statistics from plagiarism.org. 59% of high school students admitted cheating on a test that year. 34% reported doing it more than two times. 1 out of 3 high school students admitted they used the internet to plagiarize an assignment. Note, these numbers are taken from a blog that turns out is sponsored by Turnitin, the plagiarism software company. It would seem they might have a vested interest in promoting numbers that make cheating seem more commonplace. And yet still, these numbers seem disconcertingly high. But wait, there's more from a site called academicintegrity.org. Now, this site seems responsible. It's run by the International Center for Academic Integrity. It claims that it does not endorse any commercial products and that it's a nonprofit society. They aren't trying to sell us anything. Well, here are some numbers that they give. I'm just going to give the undergrad ones here. It says they asked 71,000 undergrads over 10 or 12 years, and the percent who admitted cheating on tests was 40%. The percentage who admitted cheating on writing assignments was 62%, and the total that did one or the other was 68%, 2 out of 3 students. I mean, those numbers are disconcertingly high, if you ask me. 2 out of 3 undergraduates have done one or the other? Wow. Now, I do ask myself this. How did they define cheating here? So they're asking students, do they cheat? And so students have to sort of come up with a definition of what counts as cheating. The site says students will be asked if they cheated in some form. So even minor transgressions would count. And I can see that that would inflate the numbers somewhat. But it wouldn't account for everything. So the conclusions I draw from this are this. Some students will cheat given the opportunity. Some students will cheat because instructors haven't been clear about their expectations. So for collaborative writing, for example. And some will cheat out of incompetence. They don't know what they're doing. They don't know how to cite sources. So one of the problems instructors sometimes have when talking to students about cheating is they tend to take a holier-than-thou attitude towards cheating. That is, they feel that they need to pretend or take the position that a professor would never cheat. Now let's just take a moment and examine that proposition. How often do professors cheat? Now, Benson Honig of McMaster University School of Business did a study of articles published in Business. He found that of the 279 articles he reviewed from his own academic discipline, 25%, quote, had some form of plagiarism, and over 13%, quote, exhibited significant plagiarism. Well, let's look at a couple of examples of professors cheating. The University of Regina engineering professor Shahid Azam published an article that contained text that also appeared in one of his students' master's theses. The professor explains that the two of them co-wrote articles together, and the text in the thesis was, in fact, written by the professor. Now, that explanation might solve the article issue, but it creates another one. Is it okay for a professor to write sentences that appear in a student's thesis? I don't have an answer for that, but let's take a look at Exhibit B. In 2011, the Dean of the School of Medicine at the University of Alberta, Philip Baker, gave a speech at a convocation banquet to future doctors. Parts of the speech were identical to a speech published in The New Yorker by Atul Gawande, a Harvard professor. Dr. Baker at first explained that he was inspired by Gawande's article, had failed to identify it as a source. It seems possible that Dr. Baker had been extremely busy and the pressure of having to deliver a high-stakes formal speech may have led to failing to identify this source. And we also have to consider that this was in an oral context, so it's not always clear what you're citing in an oral context. The articles I'm using for this podcast at the moment, I mean, I'm giving them, they're cited in my text here, but you're not seeing that. So what can we take from these two instances of professors and plagiarism? I think to some extent we could argue that both show the same kinds of errors under pressure that we sometimes see in student work. In the first case, for example, rules around collaborative writing are unclear, and that led to confusion about who wrote what. So if you think about a grad supervisor working with a second language master's student on a thesis, they're sending text back and forth. The supervisor is correcting some of the student's errors and so on. There's some text goes back and forth, and it becomes unclear after a while who wrote what. And especially if the grad student is doing, say, an early draft of an article, submits that to a professor who then rewrites it, because that's cool if you're co-authoring and you're submitting to a journal. But then that text that actually does get published gets then put into the master's thesis. So it's not like the supervisor was actually trying to write the student's thesis. It was an example where it kind of went backwards into that thesis because it had been previously published. That's just a bit of a mess. It's a gray area. It's unclear. In the second case, a time crunch may have led to the writer failing to give credit where credit was due. And again, it's a little bit weird. Like, if you're giving an oral talk, like, when do you put the quotation marks around some things? I wasn't at the talk. I haven't seen it or anything like this. I mean, maybe it was more obvious than that he was just taking this and not using it and so on. Where does that leave us as instructors? I think the two cases gives support to two specific actions you can take. And the first one is this. Draft a statement, let's just say a paragraph, maybe it's a one-page handout, maybe it's a group contract, in which you spell out the rules for students who are working together on documents. What can they do? What do you not want them doing? And those rules then become the guidance for them. They then know what's okay and what isn't okay. Number two, consider linked or nested assignments. And that is where one larger assignment, so sometimes people would give, say, a term paper as an assignment. Instead of doing that, you give three smaller assignments. The first of the smaller ones might be something like, have students submit a proposal for the paper that they're going to do. The second one, due a few weeks later, might be, have students submit an outline or an annotated bibliography, perhaps. That would be a separate kind of thing. And then the third thing that they do is they hand in the paper itself. And in the paper itself, what they're doing there is focusing on the argument that they're putting together and the evidence that they're submitting, because they've already got an outline that they're working from. So by breaking this into three separate assignments, You help students avoid procrastinating, and it's the procrastination that then puts them in a situation where they're under a time crunch, and then they do stupid things. These two actions are part of planning a course. And the suggestion I'm making in this podcast is just this. The more planning you do ahead of time, the less policing you're going to have to do later. Thanks for listening. This has been Teaching Writing. My name is Roger Graves, and you can find the handouts and links to the blog post at wecanwrite.ca.